This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remember, we're wrapping up Armed Forces Week in the U.S., so if you haven't taken the time to extend gratitude to the men and women you know who are currently serving, there's your reminder. Drop them a line right after the show. We heard about two Americans wounded May 14, 1945, but 3 days earlier, the Navy suffered one of its biggest blows of the Pacific War when nearly 400 men were lost in a kamikaze attack on the carrier USS Bunker Hill off of Okinawa. One would-be kamikaze was shot down, but the next two struck the carrier. 10 dropped a bomb that crashed through the flight deck and out the side of the ship before exploding in the ocean. The Japanese pilot then crashed his plane onto the flight deck, smashing into American planes loaded with fuel and ammunition, igniting a fire and a series of explosions. Just 30 seconds later, another Zero dove at the Bunker Hill, plowing through anti-aircraft fire. It dropped a 550-pound bomb and then crashed into the deck. The bomb made it down through the deck before exploding in the pilot's ready room, setting off more explosions and adding to the chaos and devastation. Al Skerritt, a native of Calgary, Alberta, Canada, who had grown up in Seattle, was 25. His wife and young son were back home in Washington State when his ship was propelled into catastrophe.
I had headphones on because I was in charge of a couple of different areas up there. I had a lot of controls.
And where was this on the ship? Where you were?
I was on the second deck down. Our ship got hit by these kamikazes.
What did that feel like where you were?
I was getting a report on my earphones and all that. We shot down one kamikaze and the other two hit the ship. I knew where they had hit because I could hear on my earphones what happened. Oh, I heard this pounding on this escape hatch. And it was from the engine room, and I opened up the escape hatch, and here there was a sailor. He was rum-dum, and he wanted to get out, and I tried to help him out, but he was too heavy. And so I saw another sailor walking by, and I asked him to come over and help me. And he helped me get this guy out of this escape hatch. And this sailor told me, he says, you know, he says, there's a first aid station now in the forward part of the ship. I could take this guy up there, and I said, oh, please do. And I gave this guy to take up to the first aid station. Oh, this officer was there, and I heard this pounding on this here hatchway. I wanted to open up this gangway, and this officer was there. He says, don't you touch that. He says, we're to keep everything locked down. And we heard this pounding, and I wanted to open it because there was somebody on the other side wanting to get out. When we did open it, it was a terrible sight. There was a pile of not just a few guys, but there was guys piled on top of one another. They'd come to the end of the driveway. I guess they couldn't see, but they had an object to climb over, and then they'd die on top. But we did open the door, the hatchway. There was a pile of sailors dead, not just one or two, but I would say there was five or six on top of one another trying to get further on.
And so people understand, you wanted to open it because you know there's someone there, but they wouldn't let you because of the fire risk? Was that the issue?
Or the explosion.
So you could, by trying to save them, you could kill a whole bunch more.
Yes, the officer wouldn't let me open up that hatch until things quieted down. This other officer came down there, and he heard about me getting this one guy out of this here hatch from the engine room. He says, Al, we're going to go down there. And he says, we put on some oxygen service masks. The canister would generate oxygen for 1 hour. And so this officer and I, we climbed down the hatchway to the engine room. And it was so dark down there with smoke and that, you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. This officer disappeared. I didn't know where he went. And so I knew I couldn't see anything down there. The smoke was so thick. So I leaned up against the bulkhead and just waited, thinking that he would come back and get me, but he never did. And then I knew my oxygen was running out on my mask. And so I said a prayer. I said, God, help me. I took one or maybe two steps. I held my hand out in front of me so I wouldn't bump into anything, but my hand grasped a railing and I knew it was a ladder. And I looked up and I saw this really bright light way up high. It looked to me like the moon. But anyway, I got on this ladder and I climbed up there. And here there was a sailor holding a battle lantern down, and he bawled me out. He says, where the heck have you been? Your officer left a long time ago, and he told me for me to stay here until you came up. And I thanked him for that. Then I went up to my locker, opened up my locker, and when I opened up my locker, there was a picture of my 2-year-old son, and I cried. Another sailor walked by and they saw me crying. And he patted me on the shoulder and he says, well, the same thing happened to me. I had people at home and I cried when I got okay. I knew that I was strong enough and well enough to still do things on the ship. So I went up on the flight deck. They were trying to get a fire out in the forward part of the ship because night was coming on and they wanted to get that fire out because that would be like a beacon where the enemy could find us. Here there was a group of guys, they put on these 1-hour masks, and this one guy, his name was Spider. I don't know why I remember that name. But he tried to get the mask on. He said, no, no, this mask doesn't fit. I can't go in there. I can't go in there. And so then the officer, he took the mask. He looked around. And I happened to be standing there, and he pushed the mask to me. He says, you're going in. And so I put on the mask, and I climbed down to the next deck down. They put a lead-in line on my back. Then they gave me an 1.5-inch fire hose. We were supposed to go back in and put this fire out. And when we got back there, well, the hose was too short, so we came back and they put more line on this hose, another 50 feet. We started to go in again and the lead-in line was too short. So we came back out and then the officer says, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go in to the top and go down to get that fire out. And then they found out that this was a electrical panel, a 440 voltage. And if we had put water on it and we were wading in 2 or 3 inches of water, we would have been electrocuted. But that didn't happen.
Well, back to when this started. You said they told you on your headphones what had happened and where the damage was. And I know that's a big ship.
Yes.
But did you feel it when the kamikazes hit?
Oh, sure. The deck was loaded with our airplanes, our planes were loaded with bombs. And it was all ready to go out and strike Okinawa.
So when those kamikazes hit, it started a chain reaction. And this damage was severe. There's fire all over the place. There are explosions, and you're getting a little piece of that picture at a time, I imagine.
Yes, I kind of knew what happened because I told you I had earphones on.
Yeah, but you didn't know that nearly 400 men were going to lose their lives in this and that hundreds more would be wounded.
Well, that's true. I remember going up on the deck, down below, and all these here guys piled on one another when we opened up the hatch, and they were dead. Wanting to find fresh air. Everything I tell you, it has to come maybe a little bit slow, but I want to tell the truth.
Well, I've got a few thoughts here. One, this was a really long day. I mean, if this starts at 3 in the morning and you're still at it, you're fighting the fire at almost dusk. I mean, I bet at the end of that day you had to be just exhausted.
Well, yes, that's true. I was exhausted. And I went around the ship to see what else I could do. This followed this officer. And this one thing that was really kind of bad, I got up to one deck, and there was a leg laying on the deck. This one guy says, "Oh, that, we haven't thrown that overboard. That came from that kamikaze." And he picked up that leg and gave it a heave over the side. Oh, and yes, I forgot, the pilot of the kamikaze, his body was laying there. And this one guy says, "Oh, look at that ring." And he tried to get the ring off of this here kamikaze. It was a nice-looking ring. And he couldn't get it off, so he chopped the finger off to get the ring. Of course, I thought that was awful. But it was really something. Then they picked up the body and threw the body over the side. It was really, it's kind of hard to understand how people could. Oh, I wanted to tell this. You know, on the ship, I thought everybody on this ship, there was 3,000 men, and I thought every one of them was just a wonderful person. But I found out that there was a lot of them that were bad. They went around and they took off watches or anything of value. They'd taken off the dead men for themselves.
And these are the dead Americans, almost 400 of them.
Yes. And that really bothered me. I thought that every guy was a good guy, but that many men, 3,000, there's bad men there too.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of things that day that nothing could have prepared you for or that you never wanted to see. And when 390 guys are killed, I imagine there had to be some of those who were guys you knew, guys you'd served with, guys you're around.
There was some, two of my real good friends that we used to talk at nighttime. Our bunks were together, and so we'd visit back and forth. We'd talk about our hometown and the people in it. And these three guys, there was one guy that him and I was good friends. He had two children, and I had one. And so anyway, we found him in the men's bathroom where he had taken off all the seats. There was a big trough. Men would just sit on these seats, and we never had any partition between us or anything. And this trough would take everything out and empty it into the sea. And this one guy that had two children, he took off all the seats, and he laid down in this trough and put his mouth at the outlet trying to get oxygen so he could live, and that's where we found him dead. Then my other two friends, we found them, they were sitting with their legs pulled up close to them and their arms around their legs, and they were dead, leaning up against the bulkhead there. So I did lose three of my special friends.
And when you see that, as you process through all of that, as you grieve their loss, does there come a point where you also say, that could have been me?
No, I never felt that. I always felt, I guess I just felt like God had me on a mission. And when that mission was over, well, then that would be it.
And at that point, the mission was far from over for Al Skerritt. It's time for another break. But when we come back, what was it like on the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill 75 years ago in the days following one of the worst kamikaze attacks of World War II? What was it like for Al Skerritt to see his wife and young son again? And the giant surprise this World War II veteran experienced decades later? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.